Today is Tuesday, June 29th, and you are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, President Biden vows to stop Iran's nuclear ambitions.
Committed to unwavering commitment to your self-defense, and we're going to be discussing a broad range of challenges, including Iran.
Plus, COVID pandemic forces Syrian refugees in Turkey deeper into poverty.
Limited people's ability to earn and then pay for the basic needs, whether it's water, healthcare, electricity.
Also, South Africa's former president Jacob Zuma sentenced to prison for contempt of court. Our top story today is in the U.S. U.S. President Joe Biden, in a meeting on Monday with Israeli President Reuven Rivlin, pledged his support for Israel's agreement to normalize relations with other countries in the Middle East. He also vowed Iran would not possess a nuclear weapon under his watch. That's U.S. President Joe Biden.
My team and I are already working closely with the Israeli government that took office earlier this month. I'm looking forward to hosting Prime Minister Bennett at the White House very soon. We're committed to unwavering commitment to your self-defense. And today we're going to be discussing a broad range of challenges, including Iran. What I can say to you, Iran will never get a nuclear weapon on my watch, as they say. I directed last night's airstrikes targeting sites used by the Iranian-backed militia group responsible for recent attacks on the U.S. personnel in Iraq.
Ukraine and the United States are holding military exercises involving more than 30 countries in the Black Sea and southern Ukraine, despite Russian calls to cancel the drills. Russia's defense ministry tested air defense systems on Crimea on Tuesday, some news media reported. The Russian military says it is monitoring the movement of international ships participating in the, quote, sea breeze, unquote, military exercises in the Black Sea, the RIA news agency reported. Sea Breeze 2021 follows a rise in tensions between NATO and Moscow, which said last week it had fired warning shots and dropped bombs in the path of a British warship to chase it out of the black waters off the coast of Crimea. Britain rejected Russia's account of the incident. Russia annexed Crimea in 2014 and says it is Russian territory, but the peninsula is internationally recognized as part of Ukraine. Russia called last week for the drills to be cancelled, and the Russian Defense Ministry said it would react if necessary to protect its national security. The exercise will last 2 weeks and involve about 5,000 military personnel from NATO and other allies, and around 30 ships and 40 aircraft. The former rulers of Ethiopia's Tigray region said on Monday they were back in control of the regional capital Mekele after nearly 8 months of fighting. The Ethiopian federal government that ousted them declared a unilateral ceasefire with immediate effect. Gavino Garay of Reuters reports.
After months of fighting in a deadly civil war, the former governing party in Ethiopia's Tigray region said on Monday it was back in control of the regional capital, Mekele, after Ethiopian military forces retreated from the city. The Ethiopian government, which ousted Tigray's leadership late last year, declared a ceasefire with immediate effect. Residents in downtown Mekele reported seeing rebel troops in the city for the first time since they were driven out by Ethiopian forces in November, and several witnesses described celebration in the streets. A spokesperson for the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or TPLF, told Reuters by phone that the capital of Tigray, Mekele, is under their control. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said he had spoken with Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed and was, quote, hopeful that an effective cessation of hostilities will take place. Monday's developments followed recent reports of an escalation in fighting between Ethiopian troops and the TPLF outside Mekele. Last Tuesday, an airstrike killed over 60 people in a town northwest of Mekele, a medical official told Reuters. An Ethiopian military spokesperson said last week that only combatants, not civilians, had been hit. The attack was one of the deadliest reported incidents in months in the region.
That's Gavino Garay of Reuters. The unilateral withdrawal and ceasefire by Ethiopian forces in the Tigray region, after months of brutal fighting, came as a surprise to many observers. The government had for months resisted international pressure to end the fighting. For more, I reached VOA's Heather Murdoch, who wrapped up weeks of reporting in the region.
I didn't see any clue that something this strange would happen, except for on the day of the election, on the 21st of June, there was some strange happenings in Tigray where I was speaking to a man at one time who said three different forces had been in charge of the town in the course of 24 hours. The government forces had left, the Tigrayan forces had moved in, and then suddenly they were surrounded by Eritrean forces and the Tigrayan forces left. It was just surprising that there would be so many handovers of the same place without actual fighting. There were deaths involved, and there was a report of an airstrike in another town, but it wasn't like combat on the ground. So that was very strange at that time, and a little bit of a prelude to what we're seeing now, which is pretty jaw-dropping.
Do you think what is happening now is as a result of international pressure, or just a change of heart or a change of tactic by the Ethiopian government?
It could be. I mean, they certainly, in their press release announcing the ceasefire, they made a detailed list of humanitarian issues that are urgent and need to be taken care of. I don't know if it's because of pressure, genuine sympathy, or both. It certainly, the impact could be that it does alleviate the humanitarian situation in some way. The region is really on the brink in terms of existence. With not enough food, there's people in danger from food insecurity, millions of people displaced living out of their homes, and it's a farming area. The region is most well known for farms, and nobody's farming, so people are getting poorer and hungrier by the day. There's also so much of the region is cut off from each other and looted and in a state of disaster, and because of the war and because of the fighting, people haven't been able to move. So, for example, hospitals will have lots of patients that arrive after being wounded, but it takes them months to get there or weeks to get there. So by the time they get to these hospitals, which are also running out of supplies rapidly, their injuries have already compounded themselves and gotten worse and got infected. So it's a humanitarian crisis that's spinning out of control. So I do think it is possible that this is part of the reason for this ceasefire. At the very least, we know that the government says it is the reason.
With the way the fighting ended or is ending, does that give you hope that maybe there's a room for reconciliation and rebuilding of that region?
Perhaps that could be the case. Maybe that could make room. I know that in the past almost 8 months of fighting, there's been a common thread of both sides saying they'd be happy to negotiate, but both sides also saying they will only negotiate on the terms that they are in charge of the Tigray region without any flexibility. But if the government is willing to be flexible on that point, I mean, if either side is willing to be flexible on either point, then it would open up space for negotiation. And the alternative does seem to be like a war that doesn't have any end in sight. So perhaps that is the beginning of some kind of deal that will allow people to live peacefully and hopefully the people in Tigray to get back to their businesses and their farms and their homes.
That's VOA's Heather Murdoch speaking with me from Istanbul. U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken has said the United States strongly supports an Italian initiative to focus on Africa in the fight against Islamic State. David Doyle of Reuters has more.
In an unknown location, fighters from the Nigerian militant group Boko Haram are seen apparently pledging allegiance to Islamic State's West African arm. The video raises fear that the group, known as Islamic State West African Province, or ISWAP, is consolidating control of the insurgency in northeastern Nigeria. And it's perhaps one reason why the threat posed by Islamic State in Africa was at the heart of talks between US Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Italian Foreign Minister Luigi Di Maio on Monday. Di Maio said he had proposed an international working group to identify and halt the terrorist threat connected with Islamic State in the continent. Blinken added that Italy has Washington's backing.
We strongly support Italy's initiative to make sure that the coalition against Daesh focuses its expertise on Africa while keeping our eye closely on Syria and on Iraq.
The militant video, which was produced by Islamic State's official media operation, comes weeks after the death of Boko Haram leader Abu Bakr Shekau. The groups have been embroiled in a violent rivalry for years, but if Islamic State absorbs Boko Haram fighters, it could focus on attacking the Nigerian military. The footage showed several hundred men, some of whom were armed, and included statements to the camera.
We are saying to our Ikhwan, we should not relent in our effort to fight the kuffar.
However, some are not convinced that the footage is evidence all Boko Haram fighters are ready to join. Bulamu Bukati, a senior analyst with the Tony Blair Institute for Global Change, dismissed it as propaganda and noted that senior Boko Haram leaders were not featured. Around 350,000 people have died as a result of the 12-year insurgency and subsequent humanitarian crisis, the United Nations said this week.
That's David Doyle of Reuters. Leaders of Turkey and France are pledging to ease tensions after months of trading insults, but tensions between them remain over their competing interests in Africa. For VOA, Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian declared Turkey and France are in what he described as a recovery period after the French and Turkish presidents met on the sidelines of the NATO summit earlier this month and pledged to resolve their differences. French President Emmanuel Macron and Turkey's Recep Tayyip Erdogan had engaged in a war of words as the two leaders competed for international influence. Sinan Ülgen of the Istanbul-based Center for Economics and Foreign Policy Studies says there's been a diplomatic breakthrough, but he voices caution.
We can talk about a reset with France, but it's a question about how deep that reset will go. This is actually part of a broader reset that Turkey has been trying in terms of its foreign relations with the West. However, none of the areas of disagreement with France have been resolved.
Libya remains a crucial point of tension. France and Turkey back rival sides in the Libyan civil war, and Paris is at the forefront of an international call for the withdrawal of Turkish troops from the North African country. Last year, Turkish and French warships almost clashed off the shores of Libya over French claims that Turkey was violating a Libyan arms embargo. But Ülgen says both countries now recognize the need for diplomacy.
There's a realization both in Ankara and Paris that some progress can be achieved if the two are less confrontational and work diplomatically towards some sort of a negotiated formula.
A Turkish presidential advisor has suggested France and Turkey could extend cooperation beyond Libya to the rest of Africa to contain China's growing influence. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
It's been a year since Beijing implemented a sweeping national security law in Hong Kong, aiming to crack down on months of pro-democracy protests. Pockets of activism still exist in the city today, with people regrouping behind an invisible front line that is harder to disrupt with tear gas and rubber bullets. Eve Johnson of Reuters reports.
In a bustling shopping district in Hong Kong, Herbert Chow is walking a fine line, selling memories of the pro-democracy demonstrations that swept the city in 2019. Chow runs a chain of children's clothing stores called Chicky Duck, but this particular shop, with its protest-themed T-shirts, stickers and pins, could cross the line into crime under the city's national security law. It was handed down by Beijing a year ago and could mean up to life in prison for what mainland China deems subversion, secessionism, terrorism, and collusion with foreign forces. Chow's shop has already been raided by police, but he says he isn't budging.
I obey the law. I haven't violated the law. The red line of the national security law is always moving. If selling these products is considered inciting the public, if they dare to sink so low, I will fight to the end.
Chow says he still hopes for a democratic future, and he isn't alone. Independent journalist Jade Chung focuses her reporting on the city's most vulnerable. She says that over the past year, self-censorship has crept in, making interviewees and reporters more careful about what they say. But she also says she has no plans to stop.
I still hope to stay and make the city my ideal place. At least I can uphold values. I don't want the new practices to replace them.
Critics say the national security law is being used to chip away at freedoms and stifle dissent. Authorities have made certain songs and slogans illegal. The public broadcaster has removed protest-related archives, and democracy books have been pulled from the shelves of public libraries. Like the shop owner and the journalist, filmmaker Kiwi Chow has his eye to the future, working on a documentary of the protests, he says, to preserve the memory.
If I really get arrested, I will find comfort in the fact that I'm being punished for carrying out justice. And so I am at peace. I have already passed the challenge of fear.
Hong Kong this week also marks the 24th anniversary of the handover from British to Chinese rule. Activist groups have applied for permission to hold a rally, but police have refused.
That's Eve Johnson of Reuters. This is the Voice of America. South Africa's former president Jacob Zuma has been found guilty of contempt of court and sentenced to 15 months in prison for defying a court order to appear before an inquiry probing allegations of corruption during his tenure. Zuma, who served from 2009 to 2018, was ordered to hand himself over within 5 days to police in his hometown of Nkandla in KwaZulu-Natal province or in Johannesburg. This is the first time in South Africa's history that a former president has been sentenced to prison. Independent researchers say the military takeover in Myanmar as giving the junta full control of the country's lucrative and conflict-ridden jade mining. That control gives the ruling military council the mining profits and leverage for consolidating power. Research group Global Witness also says in its new report that fighting has flared around mines in remote Kachin State, worsening instability in the region bordering China. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu for broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Around the world, more than 75 million people clean, cook, and provide care in private homes, according to the International Labour Organization. Their work is often demanding, informal, and unregulated, but that could be changing. Alison Lekengo Fernandez reports from Dakar.
Marie-Hélène Sagna started the academy after spending years in France.
I consider housework to be a real job, and because it is a real job, it deserves to be learned like any other job. The goal is to have professionals who will be able to showcase their skills.
Tuition for the 3 months training program is nearly $275. It's often paid for by employers or donors, as in Sen's case. She hopes to improve her skills and earn better wages.
If you asked for a certain salary without any training, you probably wouldn't get that amount. But with training, God willing, it's possible.
After training, Sanya works to connect graduates with employers and helps set terms of employment.
On ne place pas les employés n'importe où.
We select an employer who will meet our working conditions. We do not place employees anywhere. We have an hourly rate to be respected. Our main interest is to establish a win-win relationship.
Employer pays the academy a commission and management fee for each placement. Nana Plea, who is looking for a domestic help, supports worker protections and fair compensation.
Help these women. What I see is slavery. They eat after everyone else. They go to bed after and get up before everyone else.
Tilian Academy and other employment agencies in Dakar hope to change that by improving skills and working conditions. For VOA News, Alison Lekogo Fernandez, Dakar, Senegal.
The coronavirus pandemic has forced millions of Syrian refugees living in Turkey deeper into poverty, with many having to take on large debts, aid agencies say. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
Turkey is hosting almost 4 million refugees, the vast majority Syrians escaping the war back home. Most are not legally allowed to work, but instead find informal jobs in sectors such as construction, agriculture, or hospitality. When the coronavirus pandemic hit, Turkey's lockdown measures closed off many of those jobs overnight. Jonathan Brass is from the International Federation of the Red Cross in Turkey.
And as a result, limited people's ability to earn and then pay for the basic needs, whether it's water, healthcare, electricity, and as a result, the risks of falling into more difficult measures, whether it's going into debt, which is one of our main findings, What was the outcome of that?
The research by the Turkish Red Crescent and the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies showed that debt levels for the refugees have increased by 50% in the past year. Again, Jonathan Brass.
Quality and the quantity and the types of food people are eating was being reduced because they have control over that. The utilities, people were going into arrears, and they were going into arrears with their bills for their housing.
The ICRC provides cash assistance to refugees in Turkey using money from the European Union, part of the deal struck between Brussels and Ankara in 2016 to stem the flow of refugees into Europe. Henry Richwell for VOA News, London.
Indonesia is struggling with another surge of COVID-19 cases. Infections topped 2 million in June, with the Delta variant driving the current wave. And as the country's pediatricians point out, 1 out of 8 of confirmed cases are found in children, and the fatality rate among children is the highest in the world. VOA's Wendy Wikaksana reports.
I'm still being quarantined today. About to have my swab test to check if I'm COVID negative.
Vanya Silalahi spent 2 weeks quarantined in Jakarta's COVID-19 hospital with her mother and 5-year-old brother, Titus.
My second child, Titus, first got fever. He was shivering at night. The next day, I caught the same symptom, then also my daughter. Our throats started to feel sore. A week after the fever, I discovered I could not smell things.
Silalahi eventually got herself and her children tested. The results came back positive for the highly contagious Delta variant of the coronavirus first detected in India. She decided to quarantine with her 2 kids in a government facility.
I honestly felt embarrassed to be among these COVID patients. I asked myself, how did I end up here? I had been very strict when it comes to COVID health protocol. This hurts me.
The mother says she tried to keep her kids' spirits up during quarantine and got permission to bring along her children's toys.
Probably I had the most stuff on the COVID bus. I brought a scooter, roller skates, mini cars, every toy for them to play with.
Doctors in Indonesia are reporting an alarming increase in the number of COVID-19 cases affecting children. Indonesia Pediatric Society data says children make up 12.5% of confirmed COVID-19 cases in the country.
Artinya.
This means 1 out of 8 confirmed cases in Indonesia is found in children. Our data shows fatality rate among children with COVID is 3 to 5%. This is the biggest in the world.
Experts say the new Delta variant, along with loose health protocols in Indonesia, have contributed to the spike of COVID-19 cases in Indonesia. Official data show an average of 15,000 daily cases as of June 25th. Pediatricians highly recommend parents to keep their children at home.
All activities involving children 0 to 18 years old are better to be done online.
Renata counts herself lucky as she and her children are now allowed back home and recovering. From Jakarta, Indonesia, Randy Wicaksana for Eva Mazrieva, VOA News.
Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro has signed a decree to dispatch soldiers to the Amazon to curb surging deforestation just 2 months after withdrawing troops from the region. The decree published Monday says soldiers will go to the states of Pará, Amazonas, Mato Grosso, and Rondônia for 2 months. It didn't provide details about the number of troops to be deployed nor the cost of the operation. Amazon deforestation has been worsening for several years but has surged since the 2018 election of Bolsonaro, who has called for development of the rainforest. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great evening.